Thank you very much, Karen, for your kind introduction. It is amazing how people become gentle and kind with emeritus. I have discovered a wealth of kindness since I am emeritus. Yes. The topic of this lecture is not exactly a commonplace in Reformation history. While there is a long-standing tradition of studies on Jews, Judaism, and the Reformation in 16th century, the reformers' attitude towards Islam has been surprisingly left out of account. In the last few years, one can note an upsurge of interest in the topic Luther and Islam. But this makes the inadequacies of the scholarship in the field of Protestant Reformed attitudes towards Islam even more glaring and in need of correction. In what follows, I shall examine early Protestant conception of Islam in the broader context of the late medieval and Renaissance thought. Hence, the presentation is organized as follows. First, I situate the topic in the late medieval and early modern ideas about Islam in the Latin Christendom. Secondly, I summarize briefly the position of Martin Luther and Philip Melanchthon. Thirdly, I examine in some detail the approach of the Reformed reformers. And by that I mean Zwingli, Bibliander, Bullinger, John Calvin, and their attitude towards Islam. Finally, I offer some brief reflections on the thorny issues of the reformers' perceptions of and response to Islam and their place in the history of Christian-Muslim relations. So let us begin with the late medieval and early modern ideas about Islam. Nowhere in the bothersome character of the medieval influence upon the reformers more evident than in their perception of Islam. One of the Crusades' disastrous effects was that medieval Christian concept of Islam were based on ignorance, misperception, hostility, and fear. Clerics, poets, storytellers exercised their imagination to spread bizarre tales about the Prophet, his religion, and the Middle East. Muslims were depicted as enemies of the faith, cruel, barbarous people who slaughtered Christians and destroyed churches. This, incidentally, is a quotation from the appeal for the First Crusade launched by Pope Urban II. A remarkable contribution to the reappraisal of the Church's relations with Islam came from Peter the Venerable, abbot of the Benedictine Abbey of Cluny in France. A proponent of studying Islam based upon its own sources, he commissioned a comprehensive translation of Islamic sources, source material. The project included a number of texts known as the Corpus Toletanum, and most importantly, the first ever translation into Latin of the Arabic Quran, Lex Mahomet Pseudo-Prophet, which was completed in 1143 by the English monk Robert of Ketton. This was indeed intended to be a tool for aiding the conversion of Muslims to Christianity. Despite the polemical motive, the Lex Mahomet has been described as a landmark in Islamic studies. because with this translation in an elegant, elevated Latin, the West had for the first time a reliable instrument for the serious study of Islam, rather than the abstruse tales of some earlier Western Christian writers. As we shall see, it appeared in print for the first time in 1543. On the other hand, a wave of 13th century Franciscans and Dominican friars totally opposed Islam as a religion. In their missionary zeal, they either sought the martyr's crown trying to convert Muslims or wrote detailed refutations of their faith. There are, however, a few noteworthy exceptions. First of all, I'm thinking of the English Franciscan friar and, above all, philosopher, Roger Bacon, who not only mastered most of the central scientific Islamic sources, but was a real apostle of Muslim science to Christian Europe. Another noteworthy exception was Ramon Llull, a Spanish missionary among the Muslims of Spain and North Africa, who was sharply critical of both Franciscans and Dominicans, and suggested to found schools at the University of Padua, Oxford, Bologna, Salamanca, in which not only the Arabic language, but also the history, theology, philosophy of Islam were to be studied. But the crusading spirit of the time prevailed, and his appeal fell on deaf ears. Gradually, however, more information about Islam emerged, some of it from missionaries, such as Ricoldo da Monte Croce, who was a Dominican friar of Florence, who spent a decade in the Middle East, particularly in Baghdad. Few people of his age combined his personal experience in the Orient with academic learning about Islam. One needs to read his travel account, Peregrinatio, to see how profound his knowledge of Islam was. Ricoldo's best known work was the Contra Legem Saracenorum, which enjoyed a vast popularity in his time as a source, a polemical source against Islam, and was influential on later scholars, such as, for example, Nicolaus of Cusa, as well as Martin Luther. No doubt, among those particularly interested in a dialogue with the Muslim was the German cardinal and philosopher Nicolaus of Cusa, also referred to as Nicolaus Cusanus. To be sure, Nicolaus supported the campaign of Pope Pius II for a crusade against the Turks. However, he was the first in the Latin Christianity to promote an extraordinary positive appreciation of the Islamic faith. Of particular note are two works which he wrote just after the fall of Constantinople, 1453, De Pace Fidei, the Peace of Faith, and Cribratio Alcorani, which you may translate as sifting the Quran, sizing up the Quran, examining the Quran. In the Irenic treatise, De Pace Fidei, he was able to look beyond the Christian faith and to see other religious traditions as being representations of the same basic religious truths, which each religion, with each religion pointing in various ways to one truth known and possessed by Christians. You know, Latin is a language in which you can sum up in a few words very long English or German sentence. And the program of this great philosopher and theologian was una religio in ritum varietate, one religion in the variety and diversity of the rites, a program which could be on the banner of the Enlightenment. Una religio in ritum varietate. Let us move further to Renaissance and humanism. As the Ottoman Empire advanced westward from the 14th to the 16th centuries, humanists responded on a grand scale, leaving behind a large body of fascinating yet understudied works. These compositions included crusade orations, histories, ethnographic, historical, religious studies of the Turks, epic poetry, and even tracts on how to convert the Turks to Christianity. However, biblical humanists like Erasmus, Lefebvre d'Étaples, Juan Luis Vives did not know much about Islam, nor they moved entirely beyond the medieval stance. Erasmus, for example, became involved with Islam in 1529, when the Turks were standing before the walls of Vienna. It was a classic dilemma for him. As a pacifist, he sought his way cautiously, at one moment inclining towards nonviolence, at the next recoiling from the consequences. In his Consultatio de Bello Turcis Inferendo on the war against the Turks, 1529, Erasmus maintained that war is the work of the devil, but he held at the same time, these are his exact words, that arms could be taken up against Turks, Mohammedans, Saracens, Muscovites, Greeks, and other half-Christian and schismatic nations. He had, however, no illusions whatsoever about the motives of the Christians. In a surprisingly modern critique of the greed of the rulers and leaders of his time, he went on to say, the real games being hunted are the riches of the Turks, not the Turks themselves. End quote. A most impressive effort to bridge the gap between Muslims and Christians came from another humanist, the French linguist Guillaume Postel, professor of Greek, Hebrew, and Arabic in what would become the Collège de France. He established the Arabistic as academic discipline. It was the first chair for Arabistic in Europe. This eccentric, he looks very seriously in this portrait, but he was indeed a very eccentric scholar. This eccentric scholar of universal breadth had a first-hand knowledge of Islam, traveled extensively, and knew the living faith of Muslims. In 1544, in the De Orbis Terrae Concordiae, the harmony of the earth, Postel advocated a universalist world religion. The thesis of the book, The Harmony of Earth, was that all, Jews, Muslims, and Edens, pagans, could be converted to the Christian religions once all of the religions of the world were shown to have common foundations, and that Christianity best represented these foundations. Some years before Guillaume Postel, the Italian physician, historian, and prelate Paolo Jovio managed both to address traditional anxieties about the Turkish menace and to satisfy certain newer and rather milder forms of interest in the remote past and exotic present of the Islamic East. His work, Commentario delle cose dei Turchi, Commentaries on the Turks, was written for the Emperor Charles V in the wake of the devastating Ottoman victory at Mohaç in 1526. And it became the most influential text in the 16th century. So, having seen now this background, we will see these names coming over and over again as we move to the reformers. Let's tackle actually the issue of this conference, the Reformation. And let me begin by saying that the background of the Turkish invasion of Europe was, the fear of the Turks was the background for all reformers, for the Reformation era. Let us just mention a few data. 1453, Constantinople, the center of the Byzantine Empire, had fallen to the Ottomans. In 1521, Suleiman II captured Belgrade. And in 1526, King Louis II of Hungary was killed as his army was overthrown in the Battle of Mohacs on the Danube. And by 1529, the Ottoman army stood at the gates of Vienna. Now, until 1683, where the last assault on Vienna took place, the Turks were the permanent threat for the Western Christianity and for the Western civilization. They were feared as a dangerous enemy, and given this situation, it's not surprising to find reference to the Turks in the writings from almost all the reformers. What is surprising is that historians have paid very little attention to that up until now. But this is how historians sometimes work. Let me put it in a few sentences. The real situation is that, with the only exception of Theodore Bibliander, a name which is probably unknown to most of you, but who has rendered a great service to the relations between Christianity and Islam, the reformers had very limited knowledge of Islam. And in that, they did not differ from the great humanists, say Erasmus or Lefebvre d'Étaples. Why? Well, simply because Semitic philology had made considerable progress since the mid-15th century. In contrast, Islamic studies were still trapped in the cul-de-sac of the medieval polemic concepts and the spirit of the Crusades. The first generation of reformers limited themselves to draw on contemporary sources, historical or philosophical, among which we can count the sources which I have mentioned before, the Cribatio al Corani by Cusanus, or the Commentario delle cose dei Turchi of Jovio. You find those books in the libraries of the reformers. And probably they added some descriptive or polemical works of the Middle Ages, for example, Ricordo da Montecroce. But that was basically all what they knew. Luther has read some pieces of the Quran, and so did also the other reformers. We don't know about Calvin. in the translation of Robert of Ketton, of course, in Latin. So, having said that, let us move to the reformers, beginning with, of course, Luther. The first work in which Luther explicitly addresses the challenge of Islam was his work Vom Krieg wider die Türken, on war against the Turks, 1528. The main purpose of this treaty was to explain his position on whether or not German Christians could endorse a military response to Turkish advance in Central Europe. In terms of his view of the relationship between the secular and the ecclesiastical authorities, between the secular and the spiritual realm, Luther made clear that the fight against the Turks was not the prerogative of the church and should not be a religious crusade led by the church or by the Pope, but a war made in self-defense and led by the secular authority. You find here, for those of you who are familiar with the theology of Luther, the typical expression of the two kingdoms theory, doctrine. Luther wrote, I quote, "The Turk has wrongfully attacked the emperor's subjects, and by virtue of the office to which God has appointed him, the emperor is duty-bound to protect and defend the subjects with whose care God has entrusted him." The Two Kingdom doctrine, very clear. Luther's stated views on Islam in this treaty are milder than those expressed in later writings. He urges, for example, the contemporaries to also see the good aspects of the Turks. And he calls for tolerance towards the practice of the Islamic faith. When, however, he turns to handle theological issues, then he pens a scathing critic. In short, Luther argued in this writing, treaty, that the mission of Islam was chiefly to replace all other religions, and hence he was adamant in his call for a resolute war against the Turks. Not staged, however, as a crusade. The expansion of Islam and the siege of Vienna, 1529, prompted Luther to write a second treatise entitled Heer predigt wieder die Türken. Army sermon against the Turk. And here one finds a subtle but discernible change in the approach. The work most clearly reveals Luther's apocalyptic vision of his time and consequently of the Turkish threat. Turks were characterized now in this treaty as enemies of Christ's name, as Tool, Werkzeug in German, tool of the devil. I quote, "The Turks are certainly the last and most furious raging of the devil against Christ. After the Turk comes the judgment and hell." Following traditional Christian exegesis, the four beasts were interpreted historically to signify the four kingdoms of Assyria, Babylon, Media, Persia, the Greeks, and the Romans. In fulfillment of Daniel 7:20, Luther identified the origin of Islam with the small horn which had displaced the above-mentioned kingdoms. Furthermore, one important element of his apocalyptic vision of his time is that Luther mentions both the Pope and the Turk together as the manifestation of the Antichrist. The former working from within the church, the latter from outside and threatening the whole of Christianity. Please bear it in mind as we move along and review the position of the other reformers. The Turks are, as the Pope, they signify the venue of the Antichrist. Those of you who sing Luther's hymn, "Lord, keep us steadfast in thy word," might not know that Luther wrote it for a prayer service in Wittenberg in 1542, when the Turkish army was threatening again to take Vienna. Now, the second line rendered in the beautiful English translation of the 19th century, if I remember correctly, from Catherine Winkworth, the second line of the hymn goes like this: "Curb those who feign by craft and sword." But in the original, in German original, was "und steuer des Papst und Türken Mord." That is, "and curb the murderous rage of the Pope and the Turks." So there you are, the identification of the Pope and the Turk with the Antichrist. This brief section on Luther may be concluded by noting that the same theological concern shaped and characterized Philip Melanchthon's attitude towards and understanding of the religion of Islam. He also believed that the Turk was a strong candidate with the Pope for the title of Antichrist. Indeed, Pope and Turk are often bracketed by Melanchthon in such connection. Like Luther, Melanchthon went on throughout his career to read his own age through the lens of biblical prophecy. And for him it was clear. The Turk was for Europe what Babylon was for Israel. That is, a schoolmaster. This is the word which comes over and over again in the writing of the preceptor Germanie, the schoolmaster to discipline and to teach to the Christians the fear of God at the time which he saw to be the time of God's approaching day of judgment. Noteworthy is, however, that consistent with this view that the Turks were the schoolmasters, Melanchthon continued to urge the study of Islamic sources, particularly the Quran. We move to the Reformed reformers. And I will handle here particularly four, Zwingli, Bibliander, Bullinger, and Calvin. If time allowed that I could also mention a few things about Bucer, but I think these are central for our purposes. Although Reformed Protestantism was later equated with Calvinism, it owes its fundamental design to a considerable degree to the Zurich reformer Ulrich Zwingli, who, like most of his contemporaries, was concerned by the great threat to the Western Christianity represented by the Turks. However, he had no deep knowledge of Islam, nothing particularly original. He did not engage in a discussion of theological matters, nor did he take part in the usual polemics against Islam. One point is, however, interesting. Following John of Damascus, a church father of the East, who in the 8th century had regarded Islam not as an alien religion, but as a Christian heresy. So, following John of Damascus, Zwingli considered Islam basically as an heretical doctrine, not as a religion, as a heretical doctrine. His commentary on Jeremiah reveals that he conceived the Turks as God's vengeance and punishment for Europe. Having said that, one should also stress that he was no friend of the Crusades against the Turks, for the simple reason that it would put power into the hands of the Pope, which he would misuse to suppress the gospel. It is noteworthy also to remember that the father of the Reformed Protestantism, Zwingli, did consider the possibility of a missionary enterprise to Muslims as an alternative to the war. But as I said, there is very little to find in Zwingli about Islam, also because as you can see from his, from the dates, he died 1531. So that he was not exposed to the real threat of Islam in his life. Things are different with Theodor Bibliander, who became the successor to Zwingli in the chair of Old Testament at the Schola Tigurina, the academy of a theological academy in Zurich. In his approach to Islam, Bibliander was motivated by a eschatological, missiological urgency and studied Arabic with hopes of going to Egypt to convert the Muslims through missionary work, but he was convinced by Heinrich Bullinger to remain in Zurich, and we are glad that he convinced him because, as we shall see, He rendered a great, great service, not only to his church as professor of Old Testament, but to scholarship, Islamic scholarship, and beyond that, to the encounter of two civilizations. His first contribution to Protestant Reformed studies of Islam was a treatise titled Ad Nominis Christiani Socios Consultatio, not an advice to the people of the Christian name. The impetus behind this extensive account of Muhammad's life is a well-built-up biography of Muhammad. The impetus was, of course, it couldn't have been different, apologetic. What was the idea behind that? The idea was that the farther the Turks extended their faith into the rest of the world, the more Bibliander sensed a need to prepare Christians for an encounter, a contact with Muslims. It was a pastoral, if you want, also pastoral concern. But he didn't stop there. Though familiar with Arabic, he had not mastered it to the point of being able to produce a completely new translation of the Quran. Thus, he edited in 1543 the translation of the Quran, completed by Robert of Ketton under the patronage of Peter the Venerable. It was this edition, with editing from Bibliander, that was printed in Basel by Johannes Oporinus in 1543. Is a long, long title. I just read out the first two lines. The Life, Teachings, and Quran of Muhammad, the Prince of the Saracens, which is not exactly a kindly definition of the Muslims. Now, the complex and intriguing story of how Bibliander's edition made it into print cannot be told here. It suffices to say that the project of printing a Latin edition of the Quran did not come about overnight and faced many, many difficulties. Zurich's city council did not allow the publication of the book. So Bibliander tried in Basel, and the Basel City Council was divided on whether or not the book should be allowed within its walls. The tension was not eased until an influential outsider, Martin Luther, wrote a letter in support of the project. And upon receiving Luther's letter, the magistrates of Basel reversed their decision, and the Quran was published by January 1543. It comprised three parts. This is a book of one folio book, over 1,000 pages, and comprises three parts. The first contained the Quran itself. The second included several refutations of it by prominent scholars. And the final part was devoted to the history of Islam, particularly the Ottoman Empire and testimonies of life under Islamic rule. Luther's letter to the City Council of Basel was included as a preface for the volume. Additionally, there was a warning to the reader penned by Melanchthon, in which he detailed the doctrinal errors of Islam. just for you to have an idea how this book is conceived. The Bleander's approach is without doubt a philological and an apologetic one. But this is not a complete description of his undertaking. Beyond collating manuscripts and comparing Latin and Arabic texts, he also added to his edition an enormous number of marginal notes. You see them, I have indicated with the arrows. He added notes of his own to Robert's Latin translation. While some of them were polemical, there was no shortage of another sort of annotations, which were not extant in the medieval tradition. References to parallel biblical passages by book and chapter. And this philological and comparatistic approach offered the opportunity, on the one hand, to criticize Muslim society, on the other hand, to criticize the Christian society for being ignorant of its own biblical foundation. We could spend a good hour at least explaining this little page, beginning with the image here, and then the translation of Guillaume Postel of the Quran, but we can certainly not do that. Let me just conclude this part by saying that Bibliander's Mahometis of 1543 and the revised edition of 1550 became the source book for information on Islam through the 16th century and beyond, until the 30s of the 17th century. Bibliander's edition was the textbook on the Quran and the textbook of the Islamic studies. We now move to a better known reformer, I hope so at least, the second reformer of Zurich, Heinrich Bullinger. And you see from his date, 1504-1575, the conflict between the Habsburg and the Ottoman Empire formed the background of Heinrich Bullinger's ministry. It is therefore unsurprising to find so many references to the Turk. The Turks, in the writings of the second reformer of Zurich. Here I have listed all his writings. Most of them have never been studied. And with epistolary, I mean an epistolary which extends from 1531 to 1575, a few days before he died. And this a task for itself to sift it through to find mentions of the Turk and Islam. So the list of Bullinger's writings and occasional statements on Islam is long. I have chosen to limit the presentation to one work, though the most important. The head pastor of the Zurich Church wrote in 1567 a treatise called The Turk. It's a long, long treatise. Origin of the Turkish faith, kings and emperors of the Turks, and how capable they were to capture and take away within 265 years so many lands and people from Christianity. The reference to the 265 years in the title is an allusion to the Battle of Bathaeus, occurred in 1302 between the Ottomans and the Byzantine, the Ottoman and the Byzantine army. And that was the crucial Ottoman victory which started the expansion of the Ottomans. Now, please look at the publication date. It is 1567. It is exactly 1.5 years after the so-called Great Siege of Malta, one of the turning points of the early modern European history, when a heroic defense prevented the rampant Ottoman forces of Sultan Suleiman I from gaining a strategic foothold in the central Mediterranean. It is doubtful, in my judgment, that Bullinger was not aware of the siege of Malta, all the more so because this map, which you see here, is extant in the library of Zurich Library. Now, I want you to reflect on this. The siege of Malta was probably something quite similar to what we Western have experienced on September 11. Was in the imaginary of the Europeans in those years as the greatest threat to the Western civilization. It was not just merely a gripping tale of brutality, courage, tenacity, but it was the clash of two civilizations struggling for domination. And in any case, if you read the Turk, you will sense it. He says, "I want to state the truth for the truth's sake and for the benefit of Christianity." So here is a reformer who wants to grasp with this problem, with this threat. Now, although by no means up to the standard of contemporary Islamic studies, the Turk shows a sound knowledge of the Quran and Muslim religious beliefs. Bullinger ascribes to the Quran to Muhammad, not to God. He rejects Muhammad's claim to be a prophet. Following John of Damascus, he regards Islam not as an alien religion, but as a Christian heresy. The Quran, he says, rejects such central doctrines of the Christian faith as the person and work of Christ and the Trinity. The rejection of the work of Christ means the rejection of the doctrine of justification through faith alone in Christ. Bullinger charges Muhammad with inventing ways through which people deserve and gain the forgiveness of sins, such as fasting, prayer, alms, fighting, and dying in battle for the sake of Islam. For Bullinger, Muslims believe in salvation by works, like papal indulgences, and Muslims believe is Pelagian in its orientation. Furthermore, Bullinger challenges the Quran's understanding of eternal life, worship, marriage, government, as fundamentally opposed to the Christian faith. An important aspect of the reformer's criticism of Islam is the use of violence and the religious duty of the holy war. On occasion, the reformer speaks positively of Muslim and negatively of the lives of Christians. After this, Bullinger sketches the history of Islam from the beginning to his own time with, I would say, an accuracy reminiscent of a scholarly lexicon entry. You see, Bullinger was among the reformers the historian. If you can say Calvin is the exegete or the theologian, Bullinger is also an exegete, a good one, but he's mostly an historian. And he sketches the history of Islam in a very precise, accurate way. He gives an overview of the origins of Islam, its institutions, law, political structures, its spirituality, and spread. And he concludes this work, a remarkable work, with a long prayer in which he rehearses the infidelity of Christians in their faith and the disobedience of Christians in their life and works. For this, God has given them the Turk as a teacher, as an executioner, as he did with Nebuchadnezzar and others in the past. To sum up, Bullinger's approach to Islam approaches Islam from three perspectives. First, he places emphasis on the ethical view, rejection of some forms of piety, polygamy, violence, holy war. There is a strong emphasis on that. Secondly, he looks at Islam from a theological perspective, focusing his analysis on the Christological and soteriological issues. Specifically, this theological perspective is eschatologically inclined, as the conflation of the Pope and the Turks clearly indicates. And thirdly, his interest in and concern for Islam is strongly historical in concept. This is Bullinger. Let us move to Calvin. Do you recognize him? And that's very nice. This is a friend of mine who has done it. It's, Calvin, unlike Bullinger, did not express his view of Islam in a specific treatise. In the Institutes, which you can now search, of course, it's very easy to do that. In the Institutes, the word Turks occurs only once, and the designation Muslim and the name of Muhammad are not mentioned. However, Calvin's attitude toward the Islamic doctrine is extensively documented in his commentaries, sermons, and lectures, where his pronouncements are scattered in the form of brief sentences, I would almost say erratic notes and comments. If you read them, you will at first glance think that Calvin and Bullinger seem to form a common front on the question of Islam. When we look more closely at them, however, we find considerable differences between their views. The most striking characteristic of Calvin's attitude towards Islam is that he overtly avoids commenting on contemporary affairs and engages almost exclusively in theological debates. The first reproach addressed to the prophet and his followers is that they represent a heretical sect separated from Christianity, and that we have heard also from other reformers. Thus, in the commentary on the Second Thessalonians, Calvin identifies the man of sin and the apostasy with the Romanists, proclaiming the defection has indeed spread more widely, for since Muhammad was an apostate, he turned his followers, the Turks, from Christ. In the sermon on Job, more explicitly, Calvin states, devilish curiosity is not contented to be taught simply by the Holy Scripture. Behold also whereupon the religion of the Turks is founded. Muhammad has reported himself to be the party that should bring the full revelation over and besides the gospel. The other major point of the Quranic doctrine, particularly criticized by Calvin, is that Islam, like Judaism, rejects the divinity of Jesus and the Christian view of the Trinity. So, for example, in his comments on 1 John 2:23, noting that the text asserts the eternal divinity of Christ, Calvin finds the teaching sufficient to refute the opinion of the Jews, Turks, and others. Although Calvin's engagement with Islam was sharply critical, I could give you more examples, but that should suffice, it was not morally disqualifying. This is somewhat surprising given the history of Christian polemical literature against Islam, literature of which Calvin was certainly aware of. Calvin's criticism focuses on doctrine, not on ethical issues, on doctrine. This is a characteristic of Calvin. And there is another important difference between Bullinger and Calvin, which is worth pointing out. Bullinger, like Luther and Melanchthon, identified the prophet Muhammad with the Antichrist prophesied by Daniel. This is not the case for Calvin. The Pope and the Ottoman Empire are not the two sides of the same coin for Calvin. Recent scholarship has indeed found that Calvin's treatment of this of the theme of Daniel, interpretation of Daniel 2, runs counter the dominant interpretative patterns of his fellow reformers. That is to say that in the same situation of religious and political ferment, Calvin is the only reformer who, in his interpretation of Daniel 2 or 7, 8 or 11, explicitly refutes, by names, those who relate these prophecies in any way to the Antichrist. He consistently interprets the prophecy of Daniel as relating entirely to historically past events. It has been argued, therefore, that Calvin's approach is both original and unique in the history of the Danielic interpretation and sheds light on his understanding of prophecy, history, and the best way to derive present meaning from biblical past. Now, I should say that I have also found some passages in Calvin's work where he does indeed identify the Turks with the Antichrist, but there is no doubt that in a time in which the image of the Turks was equated with the Antichrist, Calvin is rather reluctant to accept that identification. And we can even postulate that he had a charitable approach, a sharp, critical, but charitable approach to Islam. Let me conclude this already too long talk. I'm sorry, I'll be soon finished. What we conclude from this brief survey of the reformers' attitude towards Islam. Many aspects of their teachings were products of the age. And this was further complicated by the fact that much of what they knew about the Turks was incomplete and based, for most part, on second-hand reports. They were careful, however, to distance themselves from aberration and excesses, both political and theological. They never embarked on the idea of a crusade against Muslims. They rather seemed consistently to grab hold of something which was enduring and substantive. We could sum up the position by saying essentially Luther's and Melanchthon's view of Islam was apocalyptic, with the Turks as the instrument of God's wrath and judgment. Theodor Bibliander must be credited with having contributed most significantly through the first published Latin translation of the Quran to a more objective knowledge of Islam in 16th century and beyond. Bullinger's approach was moralistic, focusing on questions involving religious practice that he regarded as sinful. On the other hand, the Zurich reformer, as a talented historian, was by no means oblivious of the cultural, artistic, and scientific achievements of the Ottoman Empire. Calvin was just as much concerned as Bullinger with what he regarded the moral folding of Islam. But more poignant than Bullinger, he regarded the theological issues as being properly the object of contention between Christians and Muslims. Christological and Trinitarian doctrine were the dominant themes of Calvin's polemic, which he waged with no less acrimony against the anti-Trinitarian and the Anabaptists. What insights of the reformers have abiding validity for us today? In the essence, we may say the theological issues that they highlighted point toward discussion and dialogue between Christians and Muslims may and should appropriately continue. And by dialogue, I do not mean loss of identity. On the contrary, to carry out a dialogue without confusion but without separation means going to the roots of each religious belief, avoiding the constant danger of resigning to intolerance and division. Reformers could not face it because they inherited a dualistic view of history. From the division between godly and ungodly to the distinction between the elect and the reprobate, and the enmity between the true and the false religion. But when we turn from this and consider Christ as the center of concentric circles, we become aware that there is no alternative to interfaith dialogue and religious pluralism. Indeed, notwithstanding the obvious difficulties and differences, this dialogue, which we did not begin, it began with Peter the Venerable, a dialogue which will go on after us, becomes a pole of attraction for all who are searching for a world more just and human. Thank you.
So much, Emidio, for your talk. We now have some time for questions. If there's anyone who needs to leave because you have another appointment, I invite you to leave now, and then we'll wait till the room clears a little bit, and then those who are staying for questions, we'll just let them clear so we don't have people walking out as we try and talk.
It's long. I am so sorry. I didn't think that's...
All right, thank you. So now, those of us who are left, we get to ask all the questions.
These are the elect. And the other, the reprobate?
No, we're not going to do that. We're not reprobate. They just have other engagements. That's all right.
I'm joking.
And some people can now finally sit down, which is probably nice, too. All right. So a few questions, and I'll start off, if I may. Emidio, can you tell me when the first edition of the Bible in Arabic was done? So it's the other way around. Not the Quran in Latin, but the Bible in Arabic. Do you know? I don't know offhand. Does anyone else know?
No, I don't know of the first edition, but I'm just coming from Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And my good colleague in Lincoln has her office in a building called Old Father. Mm-hmm. Now, Old Father, I happen to know because I was visiting professor in Beirut, Lebanon, at the nearest school of theology. Old Father was a philologist, American philologist, ended up as, I think, dean of the College of Humanities in Lincoln. He was very instrumental in the 20s of the 19th century to make a revision of the translation of the Bible into Arabic.
So it would make that earlier than the original.
It must have been in the 19th century.
Yep,
but there was already a revision under, or well, with the supervision, let's put mm-hmm. it this way, of Old Father mm-hmm. is called. This is an American philologist who was teaching in those days at the American University of Beirut.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. But we can easily check. I mean, there is not a great...
Other questions for Professor Kahn? Yes?
If I recall correctly, the first Latin translation of the Quran was in 1100, and I was wondering what maybe the earliest dates for the translation of the Quran or other languages were. In other words, was that the first translation of the language, or were there other translations that happened earlier than that in the different languages?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, there were bits and pieces of the Quran which had already been translated, as you were saying, in the 11th centuries, but they were just so short passages, you know. The first complete translation into Latin is the one provided by Robert of Ketton under the patronage of Peter the Venerable. This is the first for the West. Now, if you ask me for a translation of the Quran in other vernacular languages, I wouldn't know exactly the dates. But it's just a guess. We can easily check it. It must have not happened until, say, the end or even later of the 16th century, because it was used basically, you know, by scholars, by clerics, academics, but certainly not. Ordinary people would use mostly Jovian, Jovio was the best and long seller. If you traveled to the East, you would take with you that it was the guide when you whenever you traveled to the East. For the simple reason, there is a fascinating story in this book of Jovio. You know, Jovio never traveled out of Italy, never. Unlike the other Ricoldo da Monte Croce and all the other Postel went to Constantinople, he carried back hundreds of manuscripts, he studied, he wrote a grammatic of the Arabic language. But he didn't have that great reverberation which had Jovio. Why? Because it's a funny story. Jovio's book is what we might today call, among historians, an example of oral history. He just interrogated people who had escaped from prisons under the Turks. Mostly, he interrogated veterans from the various campaigns. He also, and this is a magnificent source, he asked for advice of Venetians ambassadors. Now, you should know that the Venetians ambassadors were the best informed people about the East, because Venice had so many business contacts with the East. So he put together all these pieces. He put it in a beautiful style. It was a successful book. As I said, the best and long seller, translated not only in Latin, but in almost all vernacular languages, European vernacular languages. And I have found in the library of Bullinger a copy with glosses. You know, how much he has drawn upon. It would be a very worth writing an essay only on that, you know. But Luther read certainly Jovio, and so on. Bibliander, of course, read Jovio, yes.
Other questions? I was wondering, sorry, go ahead. Yep. No, go ahead.
I have a question about Christian minorities under Islamic rule. I believe there were a number of communities that had a greater or a lesser degree of freedom, to some extent of freedom of worship and of belief and so on. And I'm wondering if that is anywhere addressed by reformers or even before them, you know, the pastoral advice or letters or theological writings. If they are offered some advice or, you know, what?
Yes. Very much so. Thank you for this question, and the answer I will give you in a moment. Let's hear. You see, I told you that Bullinger has written many things about Islam. Among others, he wrote an advice, an instruction, as you can read there, for ministers of the Christian churches in Hungary. Why? Why did he write that advice to the ministers? Because they asked Bullinger for an advice, how should we behave under the Turkish yoke? And Bullinger argued in this letter, is a pastoral letter written to fellow pastors, as long as you hold up your central aspects of your faith, try to be subject to them, pray that Christ will deliver you from this oppression, you know. And now, this is a pastoral view of the problem, but we know, of course, as historians, that with some exceptions. I mean, in Spain, for example, there were clashes. There were clashes between Christians and Muslims. But to a certain degree, there was a certain degree of tolerance. They would ask you to pay a toll for your faith, you know, it's just an indirect taxation, if you want. But basically, there was no intent to persecute the other faith, as long as it was not militant, as it happened in some moment in history in Spain, where it grew up a movement called the Cordovan Martyr Movement. Christians, committed Christians, who deliberately challenged the Muslims, the fundamentals of the Muslim faith, and I mean, they challenged the power, you know, they had the power in those days, and of course, they also act accordingly, and there were some capital executions. It's the so-called Cordoba Martyrs Movement. But these were rather exceptions, you know, than the rule. They were content by extracting, getting some money. And incidentally, mind you, my fellow Reformed Zurich authorities would do the same with the Anabaptists, you know. The Anabaptists were allowed to leave the territory of the Zurich canton as long as they were in a ghetto, possibly in the mountains, far away, and not disturbing the public opinion. And if they would not abide to this rule, well, if they would abide, they would just have to pay a tax for that. And if they would not abide, they were sent in jails, and there was the capital punishment. And so it's not that different, you know, by my fellow co-religionaries.
Any other questions? Yes, John.
Oh, John, okay, to see you.
The Reformers, it seems to me, it was impossible to separate their understanding of Islam from the attack and the threat of the Turks.
Definitely, yes. Yes. Thank you for pointing out this very crucial point. You have noticed I have always used the word Turk, because this is the word you find in the sources. For the Reformers, for that generation, it was not Islam as religion which was the threat. The threat were the Ottoman Empire, were the Turks. That's why Bullinger calls his book The Turk. They didn't know any other thing than the threat of the Ottoman Empire. Yes, this is quite important distinction.
Anyone else? Yes, go ahead.
You mentioned the analog that was often made between the Turkish Empire and Babylon. Do you see much
Not that it comes to my mind. You know, I'm just at the beginning of this whole exploration, particularly with regard to Calvin. For Bullinger, I am almost certain to exclude this possibility. I think I've read all of that. I can't remember him mentioning the Philistine or making a simile between the Philistines and the Turk. For Calvin, I am more careful because, as you know, the corpus of Calvin's writing, although searchable nowadays, and this has eased my task, you know, because I just need to digitize Turks or Turcos in Latin, and there you are. But it's not sufficient, because all of a sudden he says Mohammedans, and then you know, start over and over again. And but certainly it requires a further attention, and may I express a personal hope. There's this holy place, Mecca, for Calvin's study, as it were, could somehow inspire somebody to do this kind of work, because I'm just an emeritus, as you know. But there would be room enough for more than one dissertation, Calvin and Islam. It's a shame, as a matter of fact, that there is not a single study of Calvin and Islam. There is something which cannot be regarded as a study, which you can get in the internet from an Australian professor. I will not mention the name, which is it's not scholarly. But otherwise, there is not a single study. So, Karin, you ought to do some work.
All right, there we go. We all have this. Yes, go ahead.
I thought there was one. Is there some Agostai on?
Yes. This is the gold exception, but his dissertation is on Daniel, the book of Daniel, and this splendid. I have drawn upon him for the section on Daniel, very much so, and there is also a splendid study by Barbara Pitkins, which is, again, on the question of the Danielic interpretation in the Reformation history. But the problem is much broader than that, you know. What I said about Calvin's attitude towards Islam and the non-identification with the Antichrist is basically based on the works of Barbara Pitkins and this Dutch guy. But otherwise, I don't know, and I think I am pretty sure of the existence of another study, other studies on this.
Something we all can think about and work on a new project for us. I will draw this to a close right now, but please join me in thanking Professor Campi for his lecture.
Thank you.